Hello and welcome back to Politics and Polls. I'm Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, and this is my co-host and colleague, Sam.
Hi, Sam Wong here, professor of neuroscience and molecular biology, and faculty associate in law and public affairs here at Princeton.
So the conservative revolution that took place since the 1960s and 70s has been a subject that many historians have been interested in tackling. Historians have looked at all parts of, you know, what led from Nixon to Reagan right through our current era, through different issues from the grassroots mobilization of the right during the 1960s on issues like anti-communism to the white backlash against civil rights to the changes in the Republican Party. One area that's really interesting and important is the connection between the intellectual revolution of conservatism, the ideas that really gained a strong hold on the political landscape through this day, and the connection with some of the movers and shakers of the movement, from the people who built institutions to the people who donated money. And I think it's an important subject to try to help understand how did conservatives' ideas gain such a hold in the same polity that created Social Security, civil rights legislation, economic regulation, and more. So today we have as our guest Nancy McLean, the William Chafe Professor of History and Public Policy at Duke University, to discuss her new book, Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right Stealth Plan for America, which was published by Viking Press. She's a very distinguished historian and the author of several other books, including Freedom is Not Enough, The Opening of the American Workplace, and Behind the Mask of Chivalry, which is a real classic in American history, which is about the making of the second Ku Klux Klan. And she's published in many journals, and she's received many fellowships. She's a member of the Society of American Historians, which recognizes literary distinction in the writing of history and biography. Nancy, welcome to our show.
Thanks for having me. I'm really pleased to be with you.
So maybe we can start by having you tell us a little bit about James Buchanan, both who he is and why he was significant and how you decided to make him the focus of your book.
Well, sure. And I had never heard of James Buchanan when I set off on the research that ultimately became this book. So if your listeners haven't heard about him, they should feel like they're in good company, because very few people outside of economics, political science, and the right have. But he was a very important figure. He was the first U.S. Southerner to win the Nobel Prize in Economic Sciences in 1986. He had been born in Tennessee, actually the grandson of a populist governor, and went on to get his economics training at the University of Chicago in economics after World War II, and ultimately found himself chairing a department in Virginia in 1956 as the state was leading the South in massive resistance to Brown versus Board of Education, which is how he came to my attention. And I discovered that sort of free market fundamentalists, neoliberal scholars, you know, whichever adjective you apply, men like Buchanan, several men like Buchanan had become active in the Southern schools crisis and were, in a sense, taking advantage of the reaction to Brown versus Board of Education and the federal mandate to desegregate, seeing in that a kind of opportunity to advance their pro-market, anti-government views. And so I became intrigued with him from that story and then went on to learn how important he was in changing a lot of people's thought about government and ultimately providing the ideas that helped Charles Koch and his network of wealthy donors breakthrough in their quest to transform our political process.
And could you just, I don't know how many of our listeners know what public choice economics is, but maybe you can tell us what his arguments were and how he conceived of both government and the marketplace.
Yeah, sure. And Buchanan was part of this broad milieu of thinkers associated with an organization called the Mont Pelerin Society that was founded after World War II with a critique of the growing powers of government worldwide and the way that citizens were looking to government worldwide. And so many people within that milieu made a case for free markets and for, in their view, the superiority of markets to government for dealing with various kinds of issues. What was distinctive about Buchanan's approach and the public choice economics he developed was that he took the tools of economics that this group shared and applied them to political actors. And so he modeled, you could say, they would say, political actors as being as self-interested as market actors. And he actually said at one point, in words that were caught in a documentary, that when he set to work at mid-century, the idea of the public interest was dominant, and that politicians of all stripes would argue that they were seeking to advance the public interest or the common good. And Buchanan said, and this is his verb, he said he wanted to tear that down. So in his view, he was kind of unmasking political actors and saying these people don't really care about the common good or the public interest. That's a myth anyway. We could not possibly have such a thing in a nation with millions of separate individuals with separate values and goals and needs. And instead, he said we should think about all political actors as self-interested agents. So in the case of elected officials, that would mean that this elected official was not really, say, trying to do the best thing for Vermont or for Missouri or whatever, but actually they were just seeking their own personal interest in re-election, and therefore they would make promises to multiple constituencies in order to achieve that. And so basically he was saying, from this libertarian perspective, they were redistributing the money of particularly wealthy taxpayers, was his concern, to other groups, and those groups were illegitimately using their group power to gain things from government that they couldn't get from the market. And this public choice thought also involves a lot of attention to incentives and to kind of the rules of the road in politics. So Buchanan came to say that that people who were, you know, kind of on his team should stop focusing on who rules and think about the rules under which any political actor operated. And so there's some interesting stuff there in thinking about how incentives shape behavior and public and political behavior. And there are people with liberal leanings who are part of the broad world of public choice thought. And that would include people like President Obama's, I hate this language that gets used, but regulatory czar. Cass Sunstein wrote a book called Nudge that applied public choice ideas about incentives. So it's a broader school, but Buchanan's particular variant of that school, which they sometimes called Virginia political economy, was always, even though he publicly said it wasn't, but privately he was clear to his colleagues and his donors that this was a very right-wing project, and it was about debunking the legitimacy that the liberal state enjoyed at mid-century, and also that groups of organized citizens had, whether, you know, it was labor unions or civil rights activists or retirees and groups like the AARP. He really saw all of those things as illegitimate, coming together to exploit the wealthy taxpayer. And so he actually came to use language like that we see a lot on the right now, of make, you know, the kind of what we hear as makers and takers. And Buchanan actually used terms like predators and prey. So in his scheme, the predators would be, say, AARP members, you know, or labor unions or women's groups trying to get the government to do something to help with care work or something like that. Those would be the predators. And the prey would be, again, the taxpayers whose resources were being redistributed to others.
So this is – so in his kind of personal life, or you found the political orientation of Buchanan was what we would consider pretty conservative, as opposed to him developing this view of the kind of incentives of government bureaucrats disconnected from any kind of political agenda. You were able to kind of see who he was, and that's why he is a libertarian, or you would characterize him as a conservative. And on Brown, was race part of what motivated him, or was he a different kind of conservative?
Yeah, I'll come back to that, too, because one of the things that Buchanan did in staking legitimacy for his school of thought, for this, you know, public choice project and his particular Virginia political economy, was to portray it as just this was science, right? Mm-hmm. And all the other people who were working, you know, doing this kind of intellectual work at mid-century were just romantics, you know, and they didn't really understand understand the realities of power, and he was simply bringing, you know, this hard light of rational analysis to the study of politics. But the thing is, again, it was ideological from the start, and so I think that's really important because it really challenges the self-representation of this project. And before my book, the intellectual historian and political theorist Sonia Amadei wrote a book that looked at Buchanan in his early years, and one of the things that she noticed in his archive, she was the first person who was an outsider to this, to get access to his private papers. But one of the things that really stunned her is that his letters of recommendation regularly situated people on the ideological spectrum, you know, and commented on the soundness of their views and such, you know, hat tips to their politics. And, you know, that was something that she as a scholar was really shocked by. And I saw that also in my work in his papers. So, yes, it was always deeply ideological to use this academic field as part of what he and his co-author Gordon Tullock talked about as their grand strategy. But going, you wanted to talk about Brown in particular, right? Yeah. So it really, as I said, I had never heard of James Buchanan when I started the research that became this book. But what I was looking into was the massive resistance to Brown versus Board of Education in the South in the late 1950s. And what I was stunned by was finding that some free market scholars, I learned about Milton Friedman and only later Buchanan, but that they had gotten involved in essentially making an economics case for what the most ardent segregationists of the South were calling for. And that was, in some cases, you know, ending private education, I mean public education, but also definitely shifting public tax revenues over to private schools with the clear understanding that those schools would be private segregated schools because whites were trying to create them to get away from the mandate to desegregate public education. And what Friedman and then Buchanan brought to this was the language that we hear so much today in the case for, in the critiques of public education. So this calling public schools a monopoly, government schools, you know, saying that they were necessarily inefficient and so forth. But it was really, again, a shock to me that they would use this moment, this kind of national tragedy when the future for so many young African Americans hung in the balance, use this moment to exploit, in a sense, the crisis and make their case for privatizing a key public service and resource. So that's where I learned about Buchanan. And neither Friedman nor Buchanan nor Buchanan's partner at the University of Virginia, Warren Nutter, none of them, you know, made their case in racial terms, and they made a point of disassociating themselves from that. They said they did not believe in forced segregation, although they had never spoken out against it and continued not to speak out against it in the run-up to the Civil Rights Act almost 10 years later. But they said they were against forced integration, you know, as mandated by the federal government. And so again, they're using an economics analysis and what I came to think of as a kind of property supremacy to make their case, but they were clearly willing to exploit this white supremacy that was, you know, so much in the air at the time.
So let's drill into this just a little bit more. So This seems like a case of a dog that didn't bark. So in this economic writing, he makes arguments for the value of things that are familiar to us today, like school vouchers, freedom of, you know, I guess choosing your own schools and so on. Can you describe a little bit more what kind of evidence we have that he specifically was concerned about, say, maintaining school segregation, or rather creating a private school system? I'm trying to get a feeling for it. I didn't grow up in the South. I don't really, you know, I've heard that private schools became an awfully big thing after Brown v. Board of Education. So can we find documentary evidence that he had this as his covert goal?
Well, I don't see how anybody could have intervened as they did who had a sense of African Americans as their full equals who deserved full citizenship, because you just to turn a blind eye to all that was going on in Virginia and the wider South in this period and exploit this moment would require a kind of indifference to African Americans. I did not find, and I make clear in the book, you know, I'm not making a case that trying to say something as simple as that Buchanan was a racist, you know, or that that's what he was doing. And on the contrary, I think it's something much more chilling, which is that he and his colleagues had this larger kind of goal of advancing this pre-market fundamentalist view of the world. And to do that, they were willing to inflict collateral damage on African Americans. And Buchanan actually and his colleague sent a copy of a report that they did making the case for such privatizing of public resources in 1959. This was after two courts had said that Virginia could no longer shut down schools, which it had done. It shut 13,000 white students out of education through the whole fall of 1958 as part of massive resistance. And two courts had ruled against that, and there had been a massive white moderate parents movement against those closures and in a bid to save the schools, which was gaining popularity. 10 days after those two courts ruled, Buchanan and his colleagues sent out a report to all the members of the new state commission to decide, you know, what to do thereafter. And they made their economics-based case for privatization as not being a problem in the way that the parents had said that it was indeed a problem and it would destroy their school system. They made this economics-based case, and they had a cover note that said they were making this case, and this is a quote, which is the title of one of my chapters, letting the chips fall where they may. Letting the chips fall where they may. Now, they never said black students, you know, are going to be really hurt by this. But in the context, there's no other possible way of interpreting that. And again, this is what's most why I stayed on this trail. It just really got to me, because I don't actually think that they were motivated above all by race, but I think that there was a kind of indifference to the impact of their ideas that I think is frankly the same indifference to the impact of their ideas that we see coming from the libertarians who are standing against health care provision for people with less income now. So it's that indifference in the pursuit of this messianic vision.
I see.
That
so
it really disturbs me.
So to take it from, if I can, I'm not sure I can do this, but to take it from Buchanan's point of view, it's something like this. Society's been stable for a while. We've had segregated schools. Here I am, a white guy, although I don't necessarily think of myself that way. Here I am investigating public choice theory. And there's this social change that's happening around me in the form of this federal court ruling. And it turns out that nobody's thought of the fact that there's an economic argument for giving individuals choice over education. So in some sense, one could actually make a pretty reasoned argument that he's not explicitly calling upon racist ideas at all. He's just in some ways a conservative in the sense of wanting to conserve the old ways and pointing out ways in which that can be preserved. And so it's possible to tell a story that doesn't say anything about kids having the ability to go to a good school.
So well, I think certainly his defenders would probably see it in those terms. But again, I think it's important to realize that there was just a full-throated public debate about all of this.
I see. So everybody knew.
In Virginia. Yeah.
Right. Everyone knew that this was what the Brown v. Board of Education was. And when the school shut down, everybody knows that anybody who opens his mouth talking about schools is either for or against integration.
Yeah, well, Virginia had actually been the site of one of the cases that went into Brown versus Board of Education that I describe in an earlier chapter, when in 1951, a group of high school students in Prince Edward County, Virginia, this was before television, so the story is not widely known, otherwise it would be, because it was an amazing story. A group of high school students in Prince Edward County, Virginia, led by a young woman named Barbara Rose Johns, who since died of cancer, led a 100% solid student strike for a better high school. They were striking for a decent high school. They were attending schools in tar paper shacks. They had, you know, coal burning stoves in their classroom that would pop out hot coals, you know, during class. I mean, it was unbelievable how poor their high school was compared to the white high school. And these very ambitious students tried to organize for a better school using the tool that was there from this period of the strike. And they did an amazing thing. And they then got the attention of the NAACP, which that it would only take their case if they made it a case against segregation. The students agreed. The case became one of the cases that went into Brown. And the reason I'm saying this prehistory is important is because from 1951, there was debate about these things. So like James Jackson Kilpatrick, who later became a prominent national conservative voice, widely syndicated on television and so forth, said right after they filed their case that it might be time to start thinking about private schooling, you know, of ending public education and going to private schools. So this whole debate is out there in the air, and there's the talk about privatization was only coming from one source, and that was the segregationist, extremely repressive right. Virginia was actually the most oligarchical state in the South. B.O. Key, in his classic book on Southern politics, said that next to Virginia, Mississippi was a hotbed of democracy.
Right.
So this is a state that was like, you know, practiced extreme voter suppression, gerrymandering, et cetera. And that's also relevant, too, because none of these measures would actually have gone through the legislature if it hadn't been so gerrymandered, which, again, I think resonates with what we're seeing now. But the reason I'm emphasizing all of this is not that there's no way Buchanan wouldn't have known what the consequences of this act would be or whose side he was taking. You know, people from the black community at the time were clearly saying in the press and in public, no citizen has a right to have his prejudices subsidized at the taxpayer's expense. Right? That is a very clear argument against directing tax revenues to these private segregated academies. Even though that debate had gone on for, by the time Buchanan and Nutter issued their report, almost a decade, they still issue that report with that language of letting the chips fall where they may. So, you know, I mean, historians are trained to interpret things in context, and I think the context tells us a lot about this project. I would also add, though, too, that, and this is important, Buchanan was not known as a distinctive thinker or a creator of a new system when he came to Virginia. And he even says in his memoir, before he came to Virginia, he was more interested in yard work than in radical innovation and political economy. But it is when he gets to Virginia in 1956, in the context of these discussions of, you know, John C. Calhoun, the arch property rights supremacist, political theorist. His ideas had been exhumed to fight Brown versus Board of Education as part of this massive resistance efforts. Discussions about the Constitution and about federal and state powers were in the air, and it's in that context, that crucible of debate, that Buchanan begins to shape this public choice school of thought. So public choice doesn't antedate this crisis. It actually comes out of this crisis.
And so the other part of the story then moves to how he gets connected to various conservative figures who have remained very important in the conservative movement. So how do those relationships form? How does this economist who, at least by description, is not, you know, a particularly big figure, quote unquote, mm-hmm. but yet you connect him to this really powerful network of conservative donors who are pushing for everything, including deregulation?
Right. Well, and this actually goes back to how this project was ideological from the get-go, in that Buchanan's center at the University of Virginia was funded by something called the William Volcker Fund, which was an anti-New Deal right-wing foundation that funded all of these free market fundamentalist efforts in this period. So it paid the salaries of Friedrich Hayek at Chicago and of Ludwig von Mises at NYU. It paid for all the American delegates to go to the founding meeting of the Mont Pelerin Society in 1947, and it funded the first 5 years' operating expenses of Buchanan's new center at the University of Virginia, established in 1956, which was called the Thomas Jefferson Center for Studies in Political Economy and Social Philosophy. And so I say that because it speaks to your question about the relationship to the rest of the right. The William Volcker Foundation is the direct lineal, or let me put heard it the other way. Charles Koch's favored philanthropy, the Institute for Humane Studies, he's been on the board of it for decades now, is the direct lineal descendant of Buchanan, of this Volcker Fund that founded that funded Buchanan. So that connection to right-wing funders is just a constant thread running through this, you know, property supremacist, free market fundamentalist, whatever you want to call, you know, neoliberal project. It's a thread that runs through throughout the years. As far as Buchanan's particular center, his colleague Warren Nutter from the early 1960s was working with the American Enterprise Institute. He was also, his colleague Nutter was Barry Goldwater's only full-time economics advisor when Goldwater ran for the presidency in 1964. As they went on, Buchanan worked with and got money from all the key right-wing foundations, including, well, I shouldn't say all, but many, including the Scaife Foundation beginning in the 1970s, which was getting much more involved in politics. He also worked with Ed Meese when Ronald Reagan was governor to found something called the Institute for Contemporary Studies. He went on to help Charles Koch launch what was originally called the Charles Koch Foundation and then became the Cato Institute. Buchanan was on the board of virtually every major libertarian operation, you know, the Board of Academic Advisors, and working with Cato, Heritage, the Independent Institute, the Reason Foundation. I mean, I could go on. There are so many of them.
But is the money, I guess, the question that will come up, and it's come up, is the money, does it come with chains or handcuffs? Meaning, was this a case of conservatives finding ideas that resonated with what they wanted to do and they throw money that way? Or was there something more concerted, meaning a production of ideas for the funders? And obviously you hear this criticism on the left too. Are academics funded by liberal organizations just producing ideas for the donors? In this case, which of the two was it?
Well, I'm not sure that it can be sliced so finely, if you will. I mean, Buchanan was often making the case to funders. I mean, the correspondence of his appeals to various funders, who often, by the way, included the fossil fuel industry. You know, they've always been more conservative. You know, Shell Oil and I don't know. I can't remember all the oil companies. They're in my notes somewhere. But Shell was a big one. General Electric, a lot of these corporations that were, you know, had long been right wing. Were interested in Buchanan's work, and he would make the case to them that the work that his center was doing in changing the way people think about government was extremely important for the cause over the long term, and that's why they should invest. So he prided himself on being an academic entrepreneur. He actually used that phrase early on, and you know, he was giving them something they wanted. And also his colleague Henry Manny, who was a key entrepreneur in developing the field of law and economics, and Buchanan eventually arranged for him to come to George Mason in 1986, but Manny was the same way. I mean, I'm sure he believed in what he was doing, but he also very well understood that corporations would be extremely interested in supporting these ideas and bankrolling them. And so it kind of was an area of mutual interest. But I would say, I mean, I think, you know, Buchanan clearly had an impact in developing an original way of understanding politics and persuading many academics that that was extremely important. Interestingly, he's not much studied, I understand, in economics now, which remains, you know, much more focused on mathematics and, you know, and technical kinds of questions. But his influence on political science was very strong, and the influence of law and economics, which is, again, is a related field, has been huge. And at one point, this guy I just mentioned, Henry Manny, he used to run something with Koch funding beginning in about 1970. Charles Koch funded these summer camps that Henry Manny would run, and people joked about it as, you know, Manny's summer camp. And by the early 1990s, 2 out of every 5 sitting federal judges had gone to Henry Manny's summer camp. So we're talking about huge influence here.
So let's back out a little bit. Let's fast forward a little bit to the modern day here. So there's now a whole school of, apparently, of people who engage in public choice theory research. These are collaborators of his, students of his, students of his, students of his. Is there a predominant ideology to that community? Is there, do they specifically advocate for one particular political school?
No. And as I said earlier, public choice, the field of public choice is broader than that and does, you know, involve people like, you know, Cass Dunstein is, you know, one that comes to mind, you know, who would not be, you know, would not understand themselves as, you know, right wing or as libertarian, and would not be understood that way by others. On the other hand, from the very beginning for Buchanan and Nutter, Buchanan and Gordon Tullock, his longtime writing partner, as they were developing this field, they were very clear privately that they were excited about its political implications. And Gordon Tullock actually had, correspondence with William F. Buckley that I came across in the archives, where he was telling Buckley, this was in 65, about this new field that they had developed of public choice and how not everyone in it was right wing, but about 40% of the people in it he thought had voted for Goldwater. He himself led a group called Scholars for Goldwater, and that he thought that this would be a really important contribution to the conservative cause. So, you know, so again, it's a broader field. There are people in it who know nothing about this history, and some of them, I think, have been quite shocked to hear it. And that's, you know, part of why some are reacting strongly, because they perceive it as, you know, somehow my throwing down the gauntlet to their field of study or something. And I'm not really interested in that particular aspect of it. My concern was that I saw Buchanan developing a set of ideas to enable what he called enchaining Leviathan, and what I call shackling democracy. And I saw him work out those ideas. I saw him apply them and test them in Chile under Pinochet. And I saw him come back to the United States and begin to work with Charles Koch and give Charles Koch what he had never had before, which was a winning strategy to achieve power for a self-consciously minority cause that had been in a ghetto on the margins of American politics and is now calling the shots and dominating our politics. That was the story that interested me. My book is not a history of public choice economics. It is not a biography of James Buchanan. It is a quest to understand where that idea of shackling our democracy came from and how Charles Koch has enlisted that idea through a vast apparatus to make a very radical and effective bid to transform our political system.
Well, maybe with your last comment, we can turn to some of the debate that's unfolded and the controversy about some of the arguments. Maybe you could walk us through some of the obviously there's certain things not worth discussing and other issues that are probably more substantive and engage what you're actually arguing. Mm-hmm. Which are some of the points that have come up in the debate about Buchanan and about the book that surprised you, that you'd like to respond to? Maybe we could give you a couple minutes to do that.
Okay. Well, one thing I'd say is I knew I would be attacked by this Koch cause and for this book, because I had seen it happen to others in the sources. I mean, these people tried to get Jane Mayer fired from her job at The New Yorker after she exposed it. They hired a private detector on her. They tried to dig up dirt. They tried to convince her editor that she had somehow plagiarized, which was absurd. You know, what has been done to climate scientists is a scandal. So I understood that I was, in a sense, baiting the lion. But what I guess surprised me is just experiencing the rollout of it and seeing how irresponsible the intellectuals were as intellectuals. So you know, so you mentioned the controversy and so forth. Essentially, at this point, almost all the major, like all the mainstream review outlets that have looked at my book or radio shows or other things like that have been really excited about it and have said great things about it and really appreciated, you know, the originality of the source, the story, the analysis, et cetera. But suddenly, there was a point at which all of these libertarian critics started coming out of the woodwork, and there were two patterns to what followed. One is that it very, very quickly emerged that they hadn't even read the book, you know, that they would actually go in to find, you know, some point that they knew about and look for some chink in the armor, which, again, is a kind of standard operating procedure for people who have been working in these networks. But so most of them had not even read the book, by their own admission. And secondly, none of them was declaring their own conflicts of interest. So it was really quite a stunning thing. And I was actually approached by people I had never met who have been following the Koch network, who started sending me listings of all the undeclared, undisclosed conflicts of interest these leading critics had. And they're really quite stunning how much money they were getting as grantees of the Charles Koch Foundation, or, you know, being affiliates of the Cato Institute or the Reason Foundation. So I just want to make clear to listeners that we're not talking about some broad disinterested critique of my work that's emerged. You know, what's emerged has largely been from people who have a deep interest in this cause, and it's been an insular cause for a very long time. And I am the first outsider who has gone to the sources, researched carefully, and essentially held up a mirror to people who affiliate themselves with this set of ideas and with these institutions, and they don't like what they see. I was not setting out to bait them or to do whatever. I was reporting on what I saw in the sources, what they had written, and what they had done. If that's uncomfortable to them, then I think that should be an occasion for them to, you know, really do some self-reflection.
What's been the reaction among your colleagues, either in history or in public policy or, say, in political science? I mean, you know, you've got a couple of pretty good departments there at Duke, and it seems to me that you must get a lot of face-to-face feedback from scholars who perhaps you think well of. Can you describe that? I mean, you know, it's one thing to be attacked by people who you don't know, or even supported by people you don't know, but how about people whose intellectual background you know a lot about?
Well, so we are in the summer. I think it's worth pointing out the book came out on June 13th. So I work in my office pretty much every day, but the halls are not very full of late. But I've had tremendous, terrific reaction from historians who have read the book and who are loving it and who have said, you know, they were, you know, I don't want to use their language. I don't want to, like, engage in, you know, self-promotion or whatever, but definitely a very, very positive reaction from historians, and no negative or critical reaction from historians. I know we had a standing room only book launch at the local bookstore, The Regulator, which I guess went up on C-SPAN this past weekend. Great interest there. I've heard from, actually privately, from people in the political science department here who have felt bullied by the people who are criticizing me for some time, that they were glad to get this, to see this story out, and they appreciated the book. And of course, I have been, and this is, you know, what you're referring to, attacked by some people who are also here, but again, with deep undisclosed conflicts of interest. And so, you know, I don't know them, I don't engage them, and I didn't reach out to them precisely because I understood that they had ties to this project, and I didn't want to alert Charles Koch's, you know, broad team of people who, you know, either are employed by organizations he funds or are scholar grantees of his. I did not want to alert them to the work I was doing before it came out. So, no, of course I didn't talk to these people. You know, they've made a big deal of the fact that I didn't. But, you know, this is not a standard academic project. Right?
I see. I mean, this is interesting. So, for instance, it's been written, I mean, just to pick out one of these criticisms, and I don't mean to. I have to be very careful here because I'm not trying to be the voice of this faction. But it said, for instance, that you didn't talk with this guy, Jeffrey Brennan, who's a past president of the Public Choice Society and at your campus. And so you actually made a point of not getting too much in their face as you were doing this.
Oh, yeah. And also, you know, again, Jeffrey Brennan, you know, I have a footnote in the book where Jeffrey Brennan and James Buchanan were talking privately about who would run the purportedly academic wing of this, what became the Mercatus Center at George Mason, which was going to be Charles Koch's base camp. His main academic base camp in American higher education is at George Mason. And Jeffrey Brennan was writing to Buchanan and talking about Tyler Cohen, who has directed it for the last 25 years, as the front, you know, should they get a real front man he said, and mentioned this other student of Buchanan's who had worked in the Reagan administration and has had various positions in Koch-funded organizations, James C. Miller. Should they get a real front man like James C. Miller, or should they get, how do they put it, an academic front man like Tyler Cohen? And he went on to describe, you know, how Tyler Cohen, you know, would be a good front man for this operation. Now, that's a scholar talking about something that is supposedly a scholarly operation, but which is actually being funded by one of the wealthiest men in America, who says when he founds this thing that he wants to unleash, these are quotes, the kind of force that propelled Columbus to his discoveries through this funding. And Charles Koch says, since we are greatly outnumbered, the failure to employ our superior technology guarantees failure. So in other words, Charles Koch is making clear that these guys know their ideas are permanent minority ideas, because once the people know what this project is about, with all of its voter suppression, gerrymandering, privatizing Social Security, you know, ending regulation of the environment, you know, all these kinds of things that people don't want, not even Republican voters want. They're trying to push through this operation. They are creating a base camp at George Mason with people who then go on to Duke, like Jeffrey Brennan. Like, why in God's name would I approach someone like that when I know how complicit they had been in creating this project?
So what? What do you think the ferocity of the criticism is stronger than you might expect? Meaning, nothing about the book, but obviously a book in part about this economist is not inherently going to trigger this big controversy, or even really a book about the connections between money and conservatives and ideas. Some level, I would expect, you know, that's it's part of an ongoing debate. What is it that is driving how fierce this cabal that you're talking about, or this faction of scholars is? Is it something about Buchanan himself that they feel protective of, that he wasn't so political, or that you're connecting him to the different movements? Is it about that they are claiming that the field is somehow more political than they want it to be? Like, what is it exactly driving
that? Is it that they turn over a rock, and is it that you've turned over a rock and you're uncovering this enormous network that Buchanan is at one end of, and there's this whole other ecosystem that you're inspecting?
Right. Yeah, I think that is a good summary of it. I do think there's a couple of dimensions to this, and so one of them is, I think, almost a personal connection to, and one person who, you know, who's worked with me on this and read chapters and stuff pointed out that nobody seems to be saying that I got Gordon Tullock's personality wrong, you know, or Charles Koch. You know, they don't seem to have any defenders. So that's interesting. So where there has been bristling has been James Buchanan and, to a lesser degree, Tyler Cohen. And so and this is one explanation of a few I'll give you. But so I think one thing there that I did not realize as much going in is that these guys are sort of heroes to many people, right? And they also are people who were very good to their colleagues within this cause. I mean, Buchanan was, you know, and I do talk about that in the book. He was known for being very generous about reading other people's work and encouraging along other people in the field and so forth and so on. And, you know, he was a real gentleman, and he was a mentor to many people. And so, yes, I think there's a kind of almost like an emotional reaction that I'm toppling a hero or something, and they actually see me as being out to, I forget what somebody said, you know, what the exact language was, but I think that's part of it. It's like, that, you know, this feeling that I have been unfair to someone they know is a good man and believe is a good man. And to me, it's such an oversimplification of the issues. I mean, I don't really care about James Buchanan as a man. You know, I tried to understand him as a thinker and as a historical actor. I actually feel like I paid him the ultimate respect. I had never heard of him when I started this work, but I read just about everything I could get my hands on. The guy's got 20 pages of, you know, collected works. I read those works. I read things about him. I read others, you know, recollections. I I, you know, steep myself in the history of the milieu he had grown up in and that he worked in. So I feel like I paid him the ultimate respect. Now, his actions and his ideas are problematic. I found them problematic. Many readers are finding them problematic. But I reported what I found in the archives. So, you know, and I stand by that.
So, for instance, yeah, so for example, so one category of criticism would be considering the technical details of public choice academic works and the kinds of things that were demonstrated by particular papers. Would you say that that kind of thing is secondary to this larger story arc? I'm trying to grasp the scope of what your storyline is relative to the particular pick that happens when people come at you.
Right. So I think, so I think there are some people who work within this tradition who kind of misunderstood what the book is, you know, that they imagine that it's supposed to be a history of the public choice movement or something. And I never say that anywhere.
But it's a player in the story.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's through Buchanan and his ideas and the way that Charles Koch is enlisting insights from Buchanan's school of thought to, again, you know, shackle democracy. And, you know, we can get into the particulars of that. But the other thing, so I think, again, I am an outsider. I am holding up this mirror. They do not like what they see. But I think what makes this really explosive in a way that other works on the right or Koch maybe have not been so explosive is that I have shown these people in their own words, you know, with their own words, in their own documents, essentially making clear, you know, operating in the knowledge that they are a minority, that they cannot, that repeated experience has shown them that they cannot persuade the majority to their point of view, to their values, to their philosophy. And therefore, you have this messianic push by Charles Koch to do an end run around the democracy, to not speak transparently about what they really want and why they want it and what consequences it will have, but instead do various things to rig the process, to do radical rules change, to transform the process permanently before people understand what's happening. And elements of that are the radical voter suppression we've seen in recent years, the efforts to destroy unions, as we saw first in Wisconsin, but has happened elsewhere, without actually saying that's what you're trying to do, you know, using various specious premises to do that, trying to, you know, I mean, there's just so much I detail in the book. I don't want to get too far down that road, but I think that's it. I think the fact that showing that this is a self-conscious stealth effort has really freaked them out. And that's the important thing, because all the criticisms that are coming from these Koch grantees about me, or Koch employees in some cases, completely avoid the main point of the book, which is that this question of a self-consciously minority cause that is out to change our system radically without being clear with people about what it's doing and why. And none of them will address that, understandably. But if they don't, then, you know, I think we should also take notice. And in fact, one of the first people out of the gate criticizing me, a guy named Russ Roberts at the Hoover Foundation, I have since learned was at the 2010 Koch Donor Summit, you know, on the agenda, presenting to these donors when they were trying to undermine the Obama administration. That's also true for Ramesh Panaru at National Review, who's been one of my critics. And also, just to give your listeners a sense of how degraded these attacks are, how they degrade the public discourse, Jonah Goldberg, the senior editor of National Review, who can often be heard on public radio, you know, on NPR, speaking rationally about various matters before the public, said on National Review's website that I, Nancy McLean, should be afraid of the, quote, libertarian super posse on my ass, end quote. Okay? So that's what this has become. And, you know, I just don't see how we can, and this is the third thing I'm going to come to, and not something I often do, but I think the fact that I'm a woman who wrote this book about a cause that is overwhelmingly male and overwhelmingly white is somehow getting to these guys. Somebody else just told me, I was at a gathering this weekend, and they said that three, and I haven't actually seen the document myself, but apparently three of these men, I think they were academics from what he said, they were saying that I, Nancy McLean, am so stupid, it's a wonder I can brush my teeth in the morning. know? I mean, it's just like, is this really what we've come to, guys? Is it that pathetic, you know? And so, again, I mean, we can talk about all this, you know, till the cows come home. But what I think is really important is that their collective state of alarm. Oh, and they've also been, like, trolling people who have been on Twitter about my book. Like, anybody who says anything positive or publishes a good review, you know, just gets an earful from these guys. And some of them seem obsessive compulsive and go on to the wee hours. But again, not to get in the weeds on that, I think that takes us back to the fact that this book has hit this cause in a way that apparently nothing has yet. And I'm not saying that boastfully, but I'm saying that hearing that from people who have been longtime Coke watchers. One just told me this past weekend that they have never seen them be in such a state about something as they are about this book. And again, I think that the main reason for that is that I have their story and they don't like the public having it. And they are actively trying to kill the book because they don't want the public to read about it. And you may think
that's not exactly a strategy for killing book sales, you know.
I know.
I'm just saying here, you know, like, I mean, here you're talking, like, sounds like we're going to get a lot of correspondence here. I'm just seeing people, you know, it doesn't feel like a winning strategy for taking your book down.
I think, it's clearly the law of unintended consequences because they've drawn so much attention to it that I'm hearing from readers who were disgusted at the bullying, went out and got the book, and now are excited and telling other people about it. But what I was going to say about part of why I think this is important, too, is from my research, from the sources I had access to, it was not clear to me, like, who's actually fully in the know about what's going on here. Like, clearly people who go to those Coke donor summits know what's going on. You know, the higher-ups in the Mont Pelerin Society, where some of this was planned, know. People at the Cato Institute, where they were, you know, strategizing, will know. Which Republicans are actually fully in the know? I don't know. You know, which people who work on the staffs of these organizations, and we're talking about dozens of national organizations that are funded with Coke donor network money, and there also are state organizations, and there's an international network, the Atlas Network, it's called. So collectively, you have hundreds of organizations that are being funded by these Coke and his fellow, you know, extreme right donors. And so I don't know who all knows what, but here's one thing I do know from the research of the great social scientist Theda Skocpol and her student Vanessa Williams in a book they did on the Tea Party. They talked to more rank and file Tea Party members and attended more meetings than anybody had. And they reported that they had not met a single Tea Party person who wanted to see the privatization of Social Security or Medicare. Okay?
Yeah.
But they also spoke of the roving billionaires, meaning Charles Koch and such donors, who attach themselves to these Tea Party energies and are using that grassroots energy as a battering ram in Congress to get what they want. And those donors are not being honest with their own members that this is what they seek, the privatization of Social Security and Medicare, the privatization of education, you know, the end of environmental regulations, and this really radical right agenda. And I think that is critically important because, again, anybody has the right in our society to advocate for their views, right? I mean, I teach the history of social movements. You know, social movements stand or fall on their ability to make a case, to articulate it, to reach out to people, and to try to win a majority to their views. I respect that. You know, whatever part of the spectrum it comes from, people have a right to do that. It's an expression of democracy in action. What I really am shocked about with this cause is the effort to do an end run around that and to ultimately seal the goal, the achievements that they get from that end run, to seal them into our permanent rule book by pushing for a constitutional convention.
So it seems we're almost out of time. It seems it seems though you're making several claims that are important and connect to some of the debate and the attacks, but you know, one is this connection between ideas and funders and doing that in the history of conservatism and showing that. A second, I'd say the second two are probably the more explosive claims. A second is that the donors, at least, are not always honest, or even some of the thinkers, in terms of what the agenda is.
Right.
And finally, and I think this is important, it's not simply about, and this is in some of the criticism that I've seen that it's too conspiratorial.
Yeah, I would love to speak to that.
But I think, I mean, one of the things that comes across, I think, in our conversation, but also in reading the book, is you want to argue that the kind of political methods, not of Buchanan, but really of conservatives today, are often literally trying to undercut the democratic processes, whether we're talking about voter suppression or gerrymandering, that conservatism, at least parts of it, have become very connected to these methods of actually limiting political participation.
Yes. Yeah. And I also wanted to speak, that's absolutely true, to that question of, you know, just conspiratorial. I do not think that this is a conspiracy because it's actually worse than a conspiracy because a conspiracy involves illegality, right, by definition. And this cause is so well funded that they can hire the best legal talent to stay within the law, making it not a conspiracy, with the possible exception of violations of nonprofit law, which I think are part of the reason that the right came down so hard on the Obama administration, on the IRS, when they started looking into this. So, but basically, you know, this is all operating within the law. It's extremely shrewd. And also, I think the left has vastly underestimated Charles Koch's intelligence. I mean, the guy is brilliant. You know, he has 3 engineering degrees from MIT. He's built something he inherited, a small company, into a huge multinational corporation. And he does that by very strategic moves, by playing the long game and learning how to kind of get other people to do what he thinks is what they need to do, which is what, you know, top managers do. So this notion, though, that it's conspiracy, part of it is just like, obviously, I'm a scholar. I don't, you know, conspiracy theories are really problematic, right? I get that as a scholar. But also, we're living in a world that has such huge levels of inequality in American society in particular right now that most people don't even understand how bad it is. You know, the economist at my own institution, Dan Ariely, has a brilliant video of this that exposes just how far beyond most people's imagining our levels of inequality are. What that has meant is that some deeply ideological, very wealthy people like Charles Koch, who has compared himself to Martin Luther, right, and said he wants to unleash the kind of force that propelled Columbus. This is messianic talking. They actually have the money to create institutions, to fund people, to move a kind of agenda through. So I'm not saying that the whole of how we got to the current mess that we're in is a result of these people, but I'm saying, you know, as Julian said in his introduction to this, we've had decades of scholarship now on, you know, sort of the white backlash and the religious right and, you know, conservatives in the Republican Party, et cetera. We've had not very much at all on this kind of meeting of ideas coming from strategic thinkers on the right, like James Buchanan, and very wealthy donors on the right, like Charles Koch. And so in my story, it's that coming together of these ideas and that, you know, extensive wealth with a very driven messianic sense of purpose that has managed to really transform our political system. And, you know, we haven't been able to get to a lot of this, but in the chapter that I have on Chile, that was a testing case for Buchanan's ideas about an economic constitution that could shackle the majority. And it was a successful test, and Chileans are still struggling with the results of that now. So that's a really important example to look to have some sense of what is coming for the rest of us. But also, I don't know. I mean, I feel like there's a lot that we couldn't get to. But I think also the way that the Koch donor network has applied Buchanan's ideas about incentives to essentially turn the Republican Party into a delivery vehicle for this agenda is also hugely important. You know, we didn't have a verb called, you know, to be primaried 2 decades ago. Now we talk about it routinely. And what the Koch donor network has done is take these huge pools of dark cash, pulled together by the Donors Trust, Freedom Partners, et cetera, use those pools of money to run primary challenges against any Republican candidate who doesn't toe the line. We saw that play out in healthcare most recently. If you look at environmental legislation, in 1991, there was no difference between the parties in terms of their whether they understood the what was becoming known as global warming was man-made. Well, now there are only 8 of 278 Republicans in Congress who will admit that. This use of Buchanan's thought to shape the incentives and to the punishments operating on political actors has been hugely important in transforming one of our major political parties. And that's something else that needs a lot more attention. So I'm afraid I know we're running out of time.
Right. I feel like we can go another hour. This was a really great discussion. And unfortunately, that does wrap up our episode. So I want to thank you again, Nancy. Nancy McLean, professor at Duke and author of a new book, Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America, which is available everywhere that you can purchase a book. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Sam, and thanks, Julian.
And thanks to everyone else, and we'll be back soon on Politics and Polls.
Take care, everybody. Bye.
You've been listening to Politics and Polls, a podcast series about the 2016 presidential election produced by WooCast. The content discussed in this podcast is intended to be informational only. It does not represent nor reflect the views of Princeton University or the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs.